All right, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. We hope that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker, who Donna is a woman who obviously has been here since I came in. I've always enjoyed hearing what she had to say. I find her to be a very calming force on the planet. And so here comes Donna.
I'm Donna and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, I've got my big book here. It's my blankie. And I am going to... So we've got 40 minutes, right? All right. I've set my timer on my watch because I tell people to like go like this or whatever. Nobody ever does it, so I don't want to run over. But if it dings, I hope nobody calls me. That's all I can say. Anyway, I'm Donna, and I'm an alcoholic, and I am so grateful to be here tonight. Tim sent me an email, and I kind of had to smile. I'm sure he sends it to everybody who's going to speak, and it basically outlines, you know, we prefer you don't, you can speak for 40 minutes, we prefer you don't use profanity, and I had to smile at that. And I thought, you know, when I came in to Alcoholics Anonymous, that was about all I could do, was use profanity. So if I do tonight, well, Tim will get me. Just kidding. This guy, I've got to say right off the bat that Tim and I have been friends for a long time. And he works behind the scenes. Does anybody have any idea how much time it takes to do the tapes? I mean, he does these tapes for all kinds of meetings. He sets up for this. He brings music. He makes it wonderful. I mean, he's incredible. And he really is, to me, he is an example of the 12 step in action in AA. He's such a giving person. Love you. Thank you. It's been a while since I've told my story. On the way over here tonight, as I was in traffic and all the cars were like racing to kill each other, and I was thinking about the recent, all the political stuff that's been going on, and I was thinking about when we come in here, the war ceases. When we come in here, we find peace. No matter what race, what creed, what religion, what political opinion we have, it's all left out there. And we come in here, and this is where we find peace. And I'm so grateful for it. My brother-in-law plays the string bass for the opera. Recently they did the opera Silent Night. And it's a new opera, but it's where it's World War II, and it's at that time on Christmas Eve when the Germans and the Allied troops put down their weapons and didn't fight and for Christmas Eve. Now, I'm not going to bring religion into this. But that, to me, is what happens here. We come in here and we cease fighting because we have hit the kind of bottom where we're ready to just have peace, you know, to find peace. When I came in, I did not have any peace. I came in so far down that I was just on the brink of suicide. And if somebody asked me, like, how did I get here? I really, honestly, I don't know. I know that I had hit bottom with my drinking, and I also combined it with other substances, prescription drugs and pot. And the last 3 years of my drinking was just this downhill slide. I was in my apartment. I felt like I didn't have a friend in the world. I felt totally alone. It was like my head was screaming crazy. And I just did this, and I've heard other people say that they've done this too. I thought, well, I'm going to write a letter to my father. Now, I didn't know my father. I knew him a little, but I never really had a relationship with my father. But I sat down to write this letter, and I said, I'm lost, and I don't know what to do, and I need help. It's probably the only time that I've ever really been at that place where I could say, I need help, because I always was trying to find the answer and, you know, drum up the answer and make something happen. And within a very short time, I wandered into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And it was a speaker meeting. The girl was talking about using alcohol and drugs. And it happened to be somebody who'd been a pothead like me. So I could relate to that. But I really believe that it was, you know, it was the fact that I had gotten to that point where I didn't have any more answers that enabled me to get to this program and to finally surrender and think, maybe, just maybe, I'm an alcoholic. Maybe I am. I thought I was crazy, and I actually had a psychiatrist give me a diagnosis, and it was a pretty serious one, and not one you get over. And I had gone the whole route. When I first started drinking when I was 15. It was 1959. I drank Southern Comfort Highball with some girlfriends. It was a time where I felt like I didn't fit in anywhere. I had spent up until age 15 feeling like a total outsider, like I didn't fit anywhere, like I had this, you know, I just was so self-conscious. And it was like the whole world was just like sharp and razor blades. I just didn't fit in. And I had that drink, and my family was Baptist, and they didn't drink. So there was never any alcohol around. And when I had that drink, it was like I could breathe. For the first time in my life, I could really breathe, take a breath. I actually, they said chug-a-lug, which I didn't even know what that meant. You know, that's how naive I was. And I drank the whole thing down, and I blacked out, and then I passed out. And when I woke up, everybody said what fun I was, and they were all laughing. And I can't really say, I felt like the hole was filled up. I wasn't conscious of anything. All I was conscious of was I wanted to drink. How can I drink? And how can I? I was like an alcoholic. I think I was before I got my first drink, but from that first drink, I was obsessed with getting drunk, and that's what I proceeded to do. It took me 17 years to get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and during that time, I did all the stuff that the book says. You know, I got married at 18. My husband drank a lot too, and so we would do this whole thing of like, we won't have it in the house, or we'll only drink at parties, or, you know, we had all these rules about it. And for a while, we were able to kind of control our drinking. And I don't really know if he was an alcoholic or not. I think he could have been just a heavy drinker. And that's, if you're, is anybody in here in their first 90 days? All right. Welcome. If you're like me, I was like coming around to meetings. I was still going home and drinking and smoking pot and stuff. But I didn't know if I was an alcoholic or not, because there were people who were at the chronic stage of alcoholism. They were drinking around the clock, and I wasn't. You know, I didn't have bottles under the bed. I wasn't drinking around the clock, so I thought, well, maybe I'm not really an alcoholic. But I got this thing, the 20 questions, and they had at a meeting, and I started answering those questions, you know, they said, do you lie about your drinking? I said, no, you know. I was like, filling out, and it says if you get three or more, I think it was three or more, something like that, you're definitely an alcoholic. It was like, huh? I can't, that's not possible. But anyway, I passed the test. And there was another thing that that really helped me a lot, which was the 12 and 12, when it talks of the first step, it talks about going out and trying some controlled drinking. And as soon as I read that, I thought, there's no way I can do that. I mean, I thought at this time, like, I was political and all that when I was drinking. I was like a hippie because I moved to Southern California, and I was running around carrying signs, chanting Ho Chi Minh and stuff. I don't even know who Ho Chi Minh was, but it didn't matter, you know. But I was supposed to go to this National Organization for Women's meeting, you know. I went with my girlfriends, and we decided to go have a drink before we went. And we ended up, you know, just sitting there getting drunk. And that was just typical with me. That was typical. It didn't matter, you know, what the plans were. It could be Christmas, family coming over, whatever. If I started drinking, all bets were off. And so when I saw that, you know, and read that, it was like, there's no way I can do it. I don't know what'll happen. If I go out and, you know, go to a bar, which is where I drank the last few years of my drinking, if I go out and start drinking, I know that I cannot guarantee that I won't keep on drinking. For one thing, I knew what I would do. I would sit at the bar, I would say, I'm going to have one drink. I would have one drink, and then I would go, I think I'll do this test tomorrow. It was always tomorrow, always tomorrow. When I was about 18, I just graduated from high school, I went to see this movie, and people who know me have heard me say this, but The Days of Wine and Roses. And it's a pretty desperate movie. I mean, Jack Lemmon, he's like tearing up the greenhouse and it laying in the gutter and tied up, you know, DTs. And I came out of that movie and I thought, I need a drink. And then it occurred to me, like, maybe you're a potential alcoholic. And so, you know, by the time I got here, I really had trouble admitting to myself, because I really thought that my problems were because of everybody else. I mean, I had a mother-in-law that was a problem. My ex-husband, or my husband, was a problem at the end of my drinking, and then I left him, but I still had problems. It was amazing. And then it was just like there was always somebody else's fault. The politics were a problem. You know, what was going on in the world? It was going to be the end of the world. And it was, you know. So, of course, I drank. Who wouldn't drink if you had these problems? But I got in here and they started educating me about alcohol. And they educated me by telling their stories. And they educated me by giving me the big book and the 12 and 12, and I started to read the literature. And the big book, and when I started reading Bill's story, and when I started reading, you know, the doctor's opinion and all those things, light started to come on. It started to click for me. It was like that I really did have this disease of alcoholism. and that the disease of alcoholism was something that it was progressive and it was fatal. And that all those times when I kept trying to, like, turn my life around. You know, everybody, you're familiar with this, where you're going to make a fresh start. Now it's going to be different. You're going to get a different man, you know, a woman in your life. You're going to move. You're going to get a divorce. You're going to change jobs. You're going to, you know, and then everything is going to be okay. I mean, I moved like 42 times by the time I moved into my house where I am now. I've been there since 2001. That's the longest I ever lived in one place. I could, you know, I was always like having to move and trying to find that thing that was going to make me okay. And, you know, but when I got here, you were just saying, you know, it's not them. It's not them. It's you. And that you have a disease, and it's not personal. That disease, you know, you've got it, and it's going to take you down this road. Maybe you haven't done the yet. You know, maybe you're not drinking around the clock. But if you keep going and live long enough, because I was so suicidal, I probably would never have gotten to that point. I don't think there's a chance. But if you keep on, then alcoholism is going to kill you. It will kill you, and you are powerless over it. That's what I was told. You have no power. And what people told me when I came in was, you have to let go of all of your old ideas. This was a great relief to me. I mean, it was just such a relief. It was like what I was talking about when you come in here and we find this peace. I can't tell you the relief of just thinking, I don't have to solve all my problems. That I really can't. That I really am powerless over alcohol. And that, you know, maybe if I do the things that they're suggesting, that there's, you know, there's some hope for me. And I'm sure that anybody in here who's an alcoholic like I was, you know, who came in here with the disease of alcoholism and you're lost, you're afraid, you feel empty, you feel alone, that when you start hearing people share, you start getting this glimmer of hope, like, maybe this will work for me. So people said try it for 90 days. If you don't like it, we'll cheerfully refund your misery. And they used to say things like, the door goes both ways. You know, this really isn't a program. It's not therapy. It's not a program for people who, just stroll in off the street and think, oh, gee, I need to moderate my drinking. This is a program for people who are going to die if they don't find a spiritual connection to save them. Because before Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, I was watching this Bill Wilson movie that just came out recently, a new version, and they used to give people shock treatment. Well, they wanted to do shock treatment on me when I attempted suicide in 1970. My husband wouldn't let them, but which is good, because I need every bit of the brain cells I've got. But they used to do lobotomies. They used to lock people up in mental hospitals because they said, alcoholics, this is a personality disorder of being an alcoholic. They didn't see it as a disease. And so, my grandmother's father, he died in Milledgeville. And all I know about him was that he was a heavy drinker and that she used to be so afraid of him, she would escape out the window at night and to try to be safe. And he died in Milledgeville, and all I can think of is that what happened to him? They'd sterilize people because they were alcoholics. So we come in here and there's this program that says, you're hopeless, you're helpless, you're powerless, But here, if you do these simple things, then you will have a life beyond your wildest dreams. And that's what's happened to me. Now, I could go on and share more about my drinking past, which really, my drinking was very boring. All I know is that all I wanted to do was drink. I would sneak and drink. I would lie and drink. I would just, you know, wanted to get drunk all the time. And I loved being drunk. So that kind of sums up the whole drunk-a-lock. And so I came in here and I thought I'll give it a try for 90 days. And they said, abandon yourself to the program and give up all your old ideas. So I said, okay, what have I got to lose? I got nothing to lose. And so I started doing it. I got a sponsor. I started working the steps. As my head began to clear, I started reading the big book in the 12 and 12. And my sponsor started taking me through the steps. And they really are. The program's very simple. It's a simple program for complicated people. Like I said before, this is not therapy. It's not a matter of getting, you know, I'm going to do analysis. I'm going to figure out what's wrong with me, and then I'm going to get better and have it all together. It's a matter of, like, letting go and learning how to give up, how to surrender. And I threw myself into it, and the whole thing with the third step, you know, I understood I was powerless over alcohol by then. And that third step, I couldn't figure out what the heck they were talking about. You know, what in the world does it mean, turn your will and life over the care of God? I looked up all the words in the dictionary. What does will mean? What does life mean? You know, I tried to figure it out. And then it was just like, basically, it's saying everything. Everything. And so I was going to turn it over to the care of this higher power. I got to pick my own higher power, which I just thought, well, you know, I heard the speaker say, go into the bathroom, look in the mirror, and if you don't think there's something greater than that, you are sick. But I loved it. It was like, I think it might have been Father Martin way back when. I used to listen to tapes all the time. But he, whoever it was, the speaker, talked about this guy who's wandering along. He's on this cliff. He slips. He falls off the cliff. He grabs onto this branch. And he looks up in the sky, and the branch is starting to come out from it reminds me of the cliff in La Jolla that I got stuck on one time before I got sober. But it's coming out, and so he looks up and he says, God, if there's anybody up there, you know, save me. And this big booming voice comes down and it says, let go of the branch. And the guy goes, is there anybody else up there? And that's what it felt like to me. To let go of trying to run the show. There was that peacefulness to it, but there was also this tremendous fear of, like, I'm just going to fall off this cliff. But if you've got no choice, if it's like, let go and surrender, you know, do this stuff in the program, die. Go die. I think I'll do this. And so by the time I had my 90-day chip, I was at a camp out, an AA camp out. I was with my boyfriend. And we were with the kids because I had a son. I had two children. One died right before I got sober, 2.5 years before I got sober. And we had his daughters, and we had a foster kid, and we were all at the campfire, and I got my chip, my 90-day chip. And I had gone from being hopeless, helpless, and miserable to just being so amazed that I could go 90 days without a drink. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And to be in the company of all these people, and I will say that one of my biggest things was that I did not, if you're here and you don't feel like you fit in, then I know exactly how that feels. I did not feel love from people. I did not feel chummy. I didn't want to get along with the people. I just wanted to do what I had to do to stay alive. And, people all, let's go eat, whatever. No. Stay away from me. And I was like that a long, long time. And I had, it talks about people with grave emotional and mental disorders, and I definitely had a grave emotional disorder. So I really was not able to connect with people. I could act like it, but I just couldn't, that emotional thing, I couldn't do it. I was missing that. So there were so many times that I went to meetings, and I would leave, and I would feel so empty. But I kept coming back. It was like something kept bringing me back, and I'd feel so lonely and so empty. Without alcohol, I really felt all that. But in time, things started to change. This guy was my boyfriend when I was about 4 years sober or whatever. But anyway, he gave this book, and it was called A Velveteen Rabbit. It's not AA literature. It's about this like stuff bunny who also always wants to be real, and he's like this kid's, you know, little rabbit, and the kid throws him to the side, and you know the only way that he can get real is by being loved, and he's all on the side, and he gets all, you know, scruffed up, and all of his fur's been loved off of him and everything, and he ends up all just feeling like I'm never going to be real. And then one day, this, you know, somebody comes along and they pull him out of the trash heap or whatever it was, and they make him real. And that's what happened with me here. I came in here and I couldn't be real. And people loved me until I could be. They brought me to life like I had never been. And I didn't have to do anything to get them to do that for me. I think I've been through in sobriety. I've been through years of joy, years of despair, years of doing well in business and financially, years of great loss and difficulty. But I was taught, don't pick up the first drink. And that I had to be willing to go to any lengths, whether I'm getting what I want or not in life, that I had to be willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. And staying sober really meant not picking up the first drink. So when I got sober in 1976, May the 8th. So I have 40 years of sobriety. And it's pretty phenomenal. It is because I know that I am powerless over alcohol. And yet here I stand. And it's because of this program. And it's because of all the people who carried me along, who loved me when I couldn't even feel love. All the people who taught me how to work this program. All the people who shared their souls and their spirits with me. And this simple program. And really, over the years, I've had periods where I'd like worked the steps like crazy and periods where I didn't. My young son, as I said, he drowned two and a half years before I got to the program. And that, I really literally went insane. When I got in the program, it was like, well, I'm going to work these steps and I'm going to be so good. I'm going to be the perfect AA so that God will never do anything like that again. But I was about 16 years sober and my other son died. He died here in Atlanta. He had been beaten up by some kids at school, damaged his esophagus, or, you know, his esophagus was damaged as a result of the treatment they gave him to save him. And he died. And what happened to me was that I said, okay, this God stuff, forget this God stuff. I'll work the rest of the steps, but I don't want anything to do with God. Well, you take out the higher power from the program, and you've just got nothing. So I went for several years. I got involved in politics. I started lobbying in D.C. for this activist group and everything. Worked 40 hours a week. Did my activist stuff 40 hours a week. And I didn't pick up a drink. But I got angrier. I stopped going to meetings for several years. And I just got more and more angry. Just reverting back. And so one day I went in this grocery store and I find myself on the booze aisle with all the wine. And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking to myself, if I don't find a way to reconcile this, I am going to drink again. I'm going to have to surrender again. I'm going to have to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And by then, I was living here in Georgia and here in Atlanta and came into this NABA Club meeting. And I just thought, I give up. I mean, my ideas about God would have to change. And what happened was, in order for me to be able to get back to work in the program, the heart of the program, which is that surrender to the higher power, I had to say, I don't know the purpose of life. I don't know why he died. I don't know why he suffered like he did. I don't know why my other son died. I don't know any reason or rhyme for any of this stuff. And so I'm going to have to say, there's some purpose. I want to believe that somewhere this makes sense, but that it's not in my mind as a human to be able to figure it out. And I'm just going to have to let it go. And so that's how I found my peace. And Dr. Paul, the used to be called Dr. Alcoholic Addict Chapter, he was a good one for me too. You know, where he says nothing happens in God's world by mistake. And what I had to do with that was I had to say, I'm not going to be able to figure it out. But I'm going to have to turn my will and life over the care of this higher power anyway, or else this alcohol is going to kill me. So I threw myself back into the program like never before. I'm looking at the clock, I'm looking at my temp, yeah. I finally hit like a wall. I was like going through the motions, I was working the steps, coming to meetings, and working with others, doing 12 steps, all that stuff. But I wasn't happy. I didn't have joy. And it was like I had this, always this sense of self-hate and self-loathing that I had lived and my children had died. Why is that, you know? I can't bear it. But I'm in the program and I can't kill myself because that's like I'm not working the steps. So one day it was like dawned on me, hate is a defect of character. Hello? I was going to have to become willing to let that self-hate go. And so I got on my knees, and I knew I wasn't willing at all. I shouldn't hate myself. I mean, I shouldn't be alive. They should be alive. I shouldn't be alive. But got on my knees, and I said, God, I'm not willing to let it go. But because of the program, I'm going to pray for the willingness to be willing to let it go. And I got up from my knees. Yeah, and also part of that prayer, I just said, if I should be dead, kill me. It's fine. I am ready to go. It is okay. But if I'm supposed to live, I cannot live like this without joy. I cannot go on anymore without happiness. And so I got up, and it was like every day, every single day after that time, for, you know, a week or whatever, everything that was put in front of me was kind. Every person that I met, I shared about it at a meeting here. People came up to me after the meeting and they said, I feel so guilty about being alive because I was driving in a car and someone was killed. And they told me their stories. And they were just like me. And I turned on this television show and there was this guy, he would train bears, and he had this trained bear, and his brother-in-law wanted to do this trick with the bear, and so they set up all the, you know, they had all these protective things that they did to make it safe to do the bear, and the brother-in-law, or cousin, whatever he was there with the bear, and they were getting ready to film this little short thing that the guy wanted to do, and the bear just turned around and bit him in the neck and killed him immediately. And the guy was standing there and he was saying, I would have given anything. I would have died for him. I would have given anything to not have that happen. And now I have to live with it the rest of my life. And I thought to myself, I'm not alone. I'm not alone. You know, my brothers and sisters, this is what the higher power to me. That's what the higher power means to me, working these steps like this. That's what it means to me. It means a kind of peace, forgiveness, stuff that comes to me and that happens to me that I never would imagine on my own. To get on my knees and just pray to be willing and to have all these answers come to me and all this kindness and love come to me as a result of it. And I'll tell you the truth. I have not hated myself since that time. It was removed. Now, if all my defects of character, lust, whatever, jealousy, all my other anger, if all my other defects of character have been removed, but this one was, it was removed. And I walked out away from that prayer a different person. I was able to start experiencing joy again and being happy to be alive. And one of the things that I'm going to say, and then I've only got 3 minutes left, but is that one thing that has saved me, when I was talking about how so many years in the program I felt alone and isolated from people and couldn't really connect, as a part of the process of working these steps, I started being able to connect to people. And that's really just a total miracle. I started to care for people. When I first heard the promises, it was like, who wants that? It doesn't sound very good to me. I don't want to lose interest in selfish things. But one of the things that happened to me was that I got, you know, like that rabbit, that I got real, that I got to be human and be okay with all my faults and flaws and all my good points and everything. It was just like, and one of the things that's done it and that has really saved my life, on those dark nights when I go to a meeting and I would just feel so lonely and everybody's there, 12-step work. I didn't want to do it. I'd think, oh no, another woman to work with. You know, I mean, that's exactly how I felt when I was, you know, early sober. And then as time went on, I started to just change, and it was like 12-step work, working with others. no matter what else, I mean, the rest of the steps, I really believe I had to work the rest of the steps, and I still have to work those in my life. But that 12th step is a real lifesaver. So if you're here tonight and you just feel like you're completely isolated, you're alone, what's the use? Might as well drink. Although, you know. Just walk up to somebody. If you've got a day sober, there's somebody with less. If you've got a week or a month, or you don't have to have it all together. Just put out your hand and say, I'm glad you're here. That's 12-step work. And keep coming back. Don't pick up the first drink, guys. And it's going to be better than your wildest dreams. No, I haven't gotten rich. Not in the material way. But being human and being happy and experiencing joy and having people in my life, that is better than anything that I ever, ever imagined. Had no idea. So thank you very much for letting me talk to you.
Thank you so much, Donna. That's such a beautiful story. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight. Da da da.